Welcome, folks. Thanks for coming. thank you. Thank you for that smattering. I'm Jeffrey Leppendorf, Executive Director of the Flowchart Foundation, and so happy to be here with you today to open this amazing show and to have a remarkable reading, I'm sure. For those who don't know the Flowchart Foundation, we work to open new possibilities by exploring poetry and the interrelationships of various art forms as guided by the legacy of John Ashbery. Above us is the Ashbery Resource Center. Come on back and visit. And in this space, we have started, now that we are fully ADA accessible, as of recently, showing work that somehow engages with language. And so we have a great example of that today. We're going to hear all about it in a moment from our artist, Jill Maggie. And just to tell you a little bit about her, she's an artist who is now, and poet, based in southern Vermont, but is just back from living a dozen years in Abu Dhabi, in the Emirates, practically a dozen years. Her work is in the permanent collection of Art Jamil and in private collections in Boston, New York, Kentucky, and elsewhere. She's the author of 6 poetry collections. One of them is for sale over there. You can see Jill or Stephen, I think, in a moment, if you want to buy books after the reading. And she also ran Sona Books, a community-based chapbook press, and, of course, is the artist of Copying is to Author. So, Jill, if you would come up and maybe just tell us a little bit about the show, and then we're going to introduce your fellow readers.
Okay, great. Thank you. Hello. Thank you. Thank you so much, Jeffrey, for this invitation, and I'm looking forward to reading with Stephen, and thank you all for being here. This feels like a little bit of a homecoming. Thank you, Brandon, for helping to hang the show yesterday. Really appreciate that. Okay, so yeah, the show. To say some things about it, I think when I read my work, my poetry and a thought piece I'm going to read, it will become a little bit more full, but generally the work revolves around textile gestures and textility. So I'm interested in the fold. I'm interested in the architecture of the book being that sort of two-sided thing, which is akin to throwing the shuttle back and forth when you weave, is akin to walking. So these kinds of textile practices that I've been doing since, well, a long time, but especially since 2016, really inform my writing and also the work that you see. I'm trying to think of what else to say about the work. I think when it comes also to textile, a fragment is also a very beautiful thing, but it's a little bit of a different fragment than the fragment we might think of when we think of the ruin, or maybe what the Romantics might kind of romanticize, you know, about the missing, right? Because a textile piece can often be repieced. It's a very sort of inherently modular material. So that's what I'm very interested in. And, oh, this is also what I wanted to say. As I've been sitting in this space and rereading John Ashbery's flowchart, I am seeing all the myriad of textile references in his work. Of course, because his longtime partner sold Persian carpets actually from this space. So if we look in the corner, do you see the threads? I'm sure he repaired carpets in this space. I looked over there this morning and found a whole bunch of tools. If you even look at this wall and his own composition of putting this wall together, you can think of a pieced work, a pieced quilt. And the poem that is in the front space by Ashbery, in the introduction, he mentions a wolf-faced gesture in writing, and wolf is another word for warp. So I think we're just bringing the textile awareness, you know, into the space, and hopefully I'm echoing some of the, you know, rhythms and architectures of that and of textility in general. So I think that's all I'll say. But you should ask me a lot of questions afterwards if you have more specific questions. So thanks a lot. Enjoy the reading.
Thank you, Jill. And by the way, for those who might be listening at home on WGXC, Radio for Open Ears.
It's still Wave Sounds, is that?
Wave Farm.
Is that the Wave Farm is playing on, not to get the program? Or?
I'm not sure what you're asking. We're playing through Waveform WGXC are one and the same thing. There's a stream. If you could go to social media and find the link, I just put it in. Yeah. Or you can go to the Flowchart website where there is the announcement of this exhibition, and there's a direct link to our live. We have a dedicated live stream page on through Waveform WGXC. Right. Yeah, waveform.org, pretty yeah. sure. But then within that, we have a dedicated Flowchart Foundation stream. If you're listening at home, you know that already. You're listening. Over there... Jill will actually be working pretty much every Saturday, but one, info on the website, actually creating a new work from these fragments that she'll be literally sewing together.
Yeah, I'm going to embroider references to textile in Flowchart, and that'll become its own banner.
Yeah, which is pretty exciting. So you can come and see this living installation of Jill. And now we're going to hear a bit of reading from Stephen Motika, who is the author of the books, the book of poem Western Practice, which we do have some copies of over here, and the chapbooks Arrival and At Mono, In the Madrones and Private Archive. His articles and poems have appeared in, I'm not going to list them all, many, many journals. Stephen has taught at numerous institutions, and he is also the director and publisher of the Essential Nightboat Books. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's an honor to be here. I'm so happy for you, Jill. So happy that your work is on the walls here in such interesting ways. Your language, your images, your textures, and I'm excited to walk the show with you after we have our reading. Jill has Jill is an amazing poet, artist, teacher. She's working on a PhD. In textual poetics and philosophy, and she's also a publisher, and she had a wonderful press in New York called Sona Books, which she ran for a half dozen years maybe in the early 2000s, and she was very gracious when I was a baby poet and invited me to submit a text to her for to be included in the Sona series, and she ended up doing two small booklets. And one of the books, really cool. It's actually comes in an envelope, and it's called In the Madrones, and it's an archival project I was working on a long time ago, and it has these really cool translucent sheets, and I haven't looked at it in a long time, and it was kind of a pleasure to return to it, and it was written after my mother's mother died. It was inspired, and I just lost my other grandmother a couple weeks ago, so I was thinking about sort of archives, feminist legacies, and it seems apropos to revisit this briefly. This was from a longer project about this imagined woman who was a curator and intellectual, and I don't know, I was obsessed with her for like 10 years, and there was going to be a novel. I'm not a novelist, and then these fragments of poetry came. You talked about the fragmentary, so these are like breaks off of an imagined project, and only two parts ever came to be seen. So I'll just read a few pages from this. And they're talking about her sort of posthumously now. They didn't know anything. Amongst many photographs, two stand out. George Platt Lyons, she dressed in black and white, maybe 1951. Later, face battered, integument, smoke obfuscating. An orange light lit in this way, looking off in a way. Whether hard to tell, the rest is history, a history. This getaway, her pilgrimage, little, a frame tucked in the woods, surviving, redwoods arching, driven woods of ferns and ferns above, darker canyon, ages ringing, human intervention in clearings, in rows of pears and apples, off-named roads, an atmosphere, obscurity, fire-coated, regenerate, a code of inclone, tusk coast, crag and grass. My nightmare, civilization originates in thunder, impertinent somehow, anyhow. Noise, violence, a noise and violence that violated the ears. Ears are not now in excellent condition. Noise is noisome, nuisance, noxious, nauseous, Italian noxa meaning dung, noise pollution. In the Madrone woods of arrogance, antecedents, appetite, answering, What we are learning is how to be convivial. But where are we eating? And what are we eating? Home thought, though at home. Oracular tree, tree of dreams, the Silva. I ask her the simplest question, A through Z. A sunbelt, a hawk red to white, having this to say, avoids real uncertainty. Swept up from the ridge, misty tucked, that ocean in which the Apollonian ship capsizes, she made no effort. That ocean is language, an infliction of loamy earth from carpet, from wooded step. These trees shall be my book. Stillness, the world's avarice, affirmation of the body, does not mean a denial of words, a literal lapse into silence. The creaking, hundreds of years, ages of books, and in reading, cambiums, that too was before her. I felt her arm, the crepe paper skin, the tired wash of a letdown. I came down the worn road behind the garden. To knobby, that's Norman O'Brown, in trees, sky knobs, the page, the body, she wrote in this absence, and he, quoting a poem she could not remember or recall ever hearing him say, his citational verse, her own place, outside discipline. Raining those January afternoons, she, Benjamin, Bizet, St. Augustine, he, Deleuze, Harrison, Joyce, always, Vico, even more always, human bodies are words, in Whitman, in Song of the Rolling Earth. Through seduction, this catching in night, this golden pageant. Her books not found, thinking drives froze in the ground of being, delirium out of the furrow. Only where there is a furrow is there any point in going straight. Failings along edges, failing lines, disassociative, an ideal, these and in riddles, spoken these things before. Catching quotations, also catching. Hiking northward, stands of living oaks. Still on painting, embrace that caused great love, great loss, great trouble. Do they ask her? Do you? That tapping foot, signpost all its own. I covered her shoulder, a blanket holding, a frailty, reckoning the end. Naming, sleep crept to crypt, additional, inventioning, or is there something which corresponds, still moment of unbroken energy, quieter, strung molecules, lines of cells that these moments stretched, driving, pounding. Do you remember her gurgle? Do you remember the sea, kelp, rubber grabbing ankles, to emit great snores, shores of death's confusions? She merely floated on her back, survived it that way. Second thoughts, too late, always. I found her handwritten note, the care of an absent hand passing pages behind. In late photo, hat, bug sunglasses, green, nearly ascendant scarf, flying away with her nearly. Sand cleared everything. You and I and the others know this too. In the crypt of sleepers, one sleeper becomes aware that the rest are sleeping. Her eyes are open, but the rest of her is still asleep. Let sleep take her away. So that I became silent, a distant bird call, omits auspices, orientation, contemplation. An isolated older body opened, we that were wood, when that a wide wood was, a kaleidoscopic metamorphosis. I came into the darkened room, a yellow edge of rug, a space, to have caught another edge, to grieve the end of her. But what authority, magister or magistrate, compulsed, fielded, off Summit Road, 15th August, 1978. And the text borrows phrases changed and unchanged from the writings of Norman O'Brown. Others lifted phrases are present here, though undocumented. And special thanks to the McHenry Library at University of California, Santa Cruz. I have a couple more minutes. Yeah. So Lynn Hajenian died a week ago, and I wrote, I wrote a piece kind of inspired by her, and I thought I'd read a few pages in her memory because she was also a figure of many talents, poet, teacher, essayist, but an incredible publisher too. Her Tumba and Telos and Nyan Editions are just like, it's hard to even fathom how much she did. So it's a loss for sure. This is called From the Space of Cells. One, in this, the passing, mind making, mapping, a funeral of appearances, where to make the sense of ourselves, to fit a lantern to these glasses, a vision creates a making of seeing something that needs in need new types, conditions, or wondering if thoughts embark on the efficiency of dreams, repetitive efforts with retrospective in brightness, vision in asymmetry. Two, to capture a position of knowing, a reliance on faulty memory, crashed against, is this reality? Talking away the hours, the house, falling into a circular system, a horse race track, a nostalgic crowd, broken utilities, passing into the quotidian of passing, passage, pocket, pouch, against the beach. Three, at Santa Cruz, huge waves, snails, frocks, pale wedge conjecture, jelly stick, habitual, window tellings, social address, dress, regress, grain, desire, drain. Four, in the parenthetical, mailing habits, metonymy of metaphoric, letter, vandals, emotions, commonplace in book, telling valise, talking inwardly, every site objectifying properties and attributes, accumulating statements, a variety of sentences, sand, sound, sinks, inking, squats, in overlapping drones. Five, waves marking, tracking persons, sandman, entire green spoon, this of women, rooms of a convenience, asking to know practical momentum, manic echo, watering, water, memories motivate, gradually something verifying these words. And I'm going to close with something that isn't been needed. There's no water in it. It is just flour and a little salt. I have always been drawn to the night photos of Robert Adams, the world of dreams, the dream states, which are sometimes permitted to also be captured during the day. What's the importance of the nocturne? I was thinking of this after reading C.S. Giscombe's Seven Dreams, which reminded me of the importance of landscape. Cecil states where he wrote his poems, in this case at home in Berkeley, but also in Jamestown in the Sierra Nevada foothills. If I went to a hotel right, I'd look at the desk with a withering forlornness. Cecil wrote about a transit center, one with both trains and buses, which would be more productive for me. There I would be observed, but I would also be observing. From Giscombe, intimacy might be an answer, bottomless intimacy, end quote. The research as an act of intimacy, iterative, lifelong, archival, architecting, lupine. What is the intent on? Kenneth Irby. A question of architecture. I am interested in the modern house wearing down, wearing away, the Marcel Breuer on Cape Cod. The images transmit some utopian possibility. What can we learn about these structures? They were extravagant in their time, and now they are modest. Most innovative architecture seems to be permanently vulnerable. Is that the irony of this house, that it is perceived as being protective when really it is quite fragile? What is the discourse around fragility in architecture? I sought the book by the dead poet on the shelves, a warren of intersecting lives and languages. The Susanna Thenon book repeating in Spanish, the same signature bound again and again. I thought it was a code switching, a joke, but it might have just been a printer's error. The ritualized space heater, ekphrastic elements entailing an iterative mood. The mood of experimental poetry feels like a death. I hunted for work by the others recently passed, but gave up deciding it was buried. They were buried in boxes. The work of a text as it haunts, the way it may or may not remain present, on or off a shelf, in her hands, out of the hands. The library is a resource, but also a burden. The room must be vast, remain dry, remain dark. I learned of a library stored in South Dakota for the dry climate. The humidity brings about an end. The structured procedure as applied to a life, my life, adding lines with each passing year. At some point you stop, the work stops growing, either because of indifference or death. Now both are true. The way of accumulating material culture now seems a 20th century phenomenon. the age of mechanical reproduction and capitalism created an explosion of printed things, the things of the body, the things of the mind, the objects, each marked a time, a location. I was reminded of that first house, the Domus Aura, a mythic pass, a Pasolini film. I want to say I was running in the warm night, but it was winter. I think I wanted to see some gold, but still loved Rome. I bought some green beaded shoes. It was my first trip to Europe. I was intoxicated by a boy on the metro, ardently watching him sway as the cars moved. I've not forgotten him in more than 20 years. The bodies moved then outside of cameras. You were nude in the shower before your lover at an orgy, but not for the peeping Tom of the phone. We were forced to hold so much in. There is objection in both directions, the flowing in, the flowing out, the drainage of desire, the burying of the libidinal, the men taken from us, the elders, the daddies. I now realize I was quite alone. I rarely turn for beauty, but sometimes I see a young man who's yet to transform into a man. His features are still elfin, his body lithe, and I understand the cult of youth. I suddenly struggle to spell words, writing in this notebook, unable to keep track of where there should be two T's or the sequence of the letters. I picked up a book called Language, revered for being a masterpiece of textbook writing and a classic of scholarship. How are we being reduced? Thank you.
That was great, Stephen. Thank you so much. It's so nice to hear your work. How's everybody doing? Good? Okay, you ready for some more poetry? Yeah, woohoo! Okay, so I'm going to read a section from Speech, which Nightboat published in 2019. And what do you need to know? Beforehand, I will tell you. This book sort of features a person walking through a city and thinking. And she is walking through a city that's kind of like a city in the Middle East and kind of like the city of Chicago. Two middles. And she's in middle age, too. And so I'm going to read that, and then I'm going to read something like a thought piece, something like an essay that's brand new and also maybe uncooked, like here. Your house's project, though. Very exciting. Okay, so let's start with Speech. The section is called, Now Words Float Down, See the Gentle of That. And it starts with a little quote from The Poems of Lal Dead, translated by Ranjit Hoskot. Good or bad, I'm happy to welcome both. I don't hear with my ears. I don't see with my eyes. A voice speaks inside my heart. My jewel lamp burns bright, even in the rampaging wind. I would look up from this work, put gardenias in my hair. She who shuffles, I, stirring my bag for an inventory of what spills. I would garden the vines, turning from my roots, my internet twines. Is this which continent? Is this the tap of fingernails on a keyboard? That's not speaking, so feminine, so deferred. Some say anything in speech is an event. Council housing windows, can they speak? Where eyes canyon the daily news. Applause in the rap battle courtyard. Some say that's not here, not speech enough. Or listening to resist practices, batik being one if you tie your tongue as string around bundles of fabric, so hacking the engine of speech. The futurists over there doing something to the library tour guide stop their mauling, but they will start again at another historical intersection, despite protect, despite rights. If an artist, if I put lemons on a plate and paint, that would my speech be? If I protest, this is why art not always posters. So carry my dividing line with me, then speech makes sense of what is not said, such as mahogany paneled rooms repeating privilege on one side of a city, making the other. This classroom repeats, broadcasting its paneling murmurs, its progeny mirrors, its secret how-to. I wrote about speech but did not know the memory of workers attempting to cross the highway in the seam of sunset and headlights. They lean against guardrails until. I watch my breath shallowing as they billow their shirts in shifts behind a fence crossed. I look again and see them sitting peacefully on the embankment on the other side of a sunset of a normal evening conversation. A group wades out into the mangroves, memorizing the hidden routes of a day off. So this watching means I reject speech class, where over-teaching combs away the mistake, where the video shows where I should start, middle, and end. I want the tricky nets. Please give me all the tricky nets. Because safety envelops speechgoers who can pay for the curb to cross safely, to hold their morals by the stem of the glass and sip in vestibules where serving trays deliver speech, deliver an identity of ideas. And why I won't practice the headset, there are too many arms, because my ancestors won't fit. Still to be paid, I partake in their public relations until my smooth muscle rejects, until a nasty little nibble on the finger pointing. Still to be paid, I stay outside as I walk inside and share a claim to taste, to fold along the seam. For to teach and read the impossible is to know the possibility of the multi-logic. Look under the study, perform the ableness not to belong, stop and wander, cast a lazy net, poke holes in the nativist curtain, dig a passage to a province inside of me to upturn my own containers who would write a biography of rights. If I disagree using my speech while moving toward you, if my skin disagrees with our rights, if you choke on my speech, if I choke on your body, if I exist disagreeing moving toward you, if you snap my edge, then the risk is living where to be is a risky quote. The archive first was family, how she, corrupter, kept place out of place, making a portable horizon from the diagonal, her fingers pulling the thread, the ontology of mistake, where she set up a laboratory political, so refugee, so to step off the curb of guidelines, the curb of a sentence. She drew a roving across her body, snagging the grid of official family, patriot archive, drawing a feather, a father, in code, in total, a system shouldering, being almost dead, stepping over citizen, non or dis, liberty, anti-body. His papers naturalized and lost learned her then how to, a man without a country, weave. Now words float down, see the gentle of that. In his office, retyping through sheets of carbon, I live this carbon. He clicks away at my art surface, letting us be citizens, his fingers still click, typing. Thin paper floats between us, and others may wonder what can be taught. I wonder also. They wait for certain speech, but I am inclined to withhold until. Because the partial is a trap, and not knowing pulls at the fabric of the south side or asks who in class can report back to an official. Real is also, I need a nice dress, not on credit, is not a violation of what my mother taught. Writing, not using a pen. Logos, overvalued. Painting, scripting. What if flatness is an ability to love, not to decide what is next to say or authentic, only recopy existing texts to transmit the distance between speech and power. Now pieces of paper float up. I don't understand that, but they keep floating up and up in this wind that unsettles the unbuilt area. If this city is not a daily diary, then papers float up blank, fluttering all the small cameras as my perception matters finds itself lonely and surveilled. Oceans away. While some minarets were made to shake in earthquakes, some raised because of rights, some conversations listened into softly, Some virtual pages all lift up, seismic and blocked. Entire pages purchased and rescinded as an information corporation eats and eats as we feed it an idea of freedom, a satisfied uplift. Or, if recopying is to author, then everyone walks out from under the library, scratching keys against the vitrines, saying, let's revamp protocols of inquiry. I think I'll stop there with that section. I can't remember who that's a quote from, let's revamp protocols of inquiry, but it's a quote, and I'm going to try to do that. Let's revamp some protocols of inquiry. So I'll read to you from something that is an extended inquiry on textiles. I think that's kind of self-contained. Okay, here we go. The nonviolence, the spinning of poetry. A proposition whereby poetry is a type of political practice. Not that poets are better people, or that poetry should deliver a political message in either form or content or both, but that in its use of everyday material, language and its simultaneous disengagement with the everyday, poetry, may be a practice of nonviolence akin to spinning. Bringing us back around to Gandhi, who prescribed spinning for the Indian people as a practice of Hind Swaraj, or self-rule. An action that could teach the texture of freedom in its unfreedom or insistence on making without fusion, instant by instant. And if we slow down here, remembering what spinning is and does, we come to the structure of a spun thread, the void inside the twist, a kind of crux of the matter, place of radical experiment in freedom, in that an arrival does not exist, and the center must remain void. At either end, the thread may continue, more unspun material easily joining up. Where poetry is not necessarily written down, is infinite, not necessarily disseminated or public. To begin again, here's a meditation on thread's structure. A thread is usually never one strand, and in its making, in order to be of use, the one who spins will put a single ply of thread together with at least one other. They will be twisted together. What is the space inside the twist? The space which is made again and again, continuously, always, as spinning occurs. The cipher comes to mind. In hip-hop, this is the name for the circle of beatboxers, rappers, dancers who, while facing in toward one another, a kind of generative spiral, make the space where something else happens. Out of the point of all intersections, a middle, a center of enmeshments, a zero point in present time, makes the cipher what it is. Cipher, from the Arabic sifr, or zero. Sounds are brought to the circle. New information comes back up, allowing for those who make the circle to offer something new back. Also, think of the way bellows work, or resonant breathing, where the top, the zero, the bottom, the finish is also the beginning. That hold of breath, which is fullness and stillness at the same time. Let's sit a little longer with this notion of spinning as unproductive space, the center of the spin as cipher, as zero, being a shape that actively stays empty. Gandhi did not prescribe spinning in order for the Indian people to amass yards and yards of yarn to sell or to use in weaving. He was not advocating for establishing a commercial enterprise. What is the meaning of his prescribing an unproductive yet making action? Again, I turn to Faisal Devji, whose book, The Impossible Indian, something Andrew and I talked about, sort of like, we don't get this book. The Impossible Indian articulates that Gandhi understood the action of spinning as a way to kinesthetically form and reform a zero, the spinning being a kind of centering, you can think of pottery also, requiring moment-to-moment attention, able to sense the unorganized fiber work with the fingers to pull the raw fiber into the spin, initiate the twirl of the spindle or the rotation of the wheel, draw out a line of spun yarn or thread. If we meditate on the idea of producing a nothing, we might better understand how Gandhi was interested in nonviolence as an end in itself. After some nonviolent actions failed, in his view, resulted in murders breaking with the promise of nonviolence, Gandhi began to think of the productivity of violence, believing that it was a byproduct of creativity. He wondered how the people could be trained in something creative, a kind of focused violence. He settled on spinning and celibacy as actions whose material engagement and productive detachment, especially in the case of spinning, would provide experiments in freedom. Spinning, especially, was closely tied to everyday life. I traveled in South India, where truly the textile arts are cottage industries, so spinning happens inside the house, as does often weaving and other things, a kind of vernacular action practiced or witnessed in many households. This, as Devji explains, provided what Gandhi considered a counterpoint to the increasingly abstract and idealized morality and politics of contemporary life. Engaging in the well-worn physical and material pathways of spinning thread or yarn, Indian people could both protect themselves from politics wedded to a notion of some productive future, as well as release into an experiment of freedom which was momentary, and therefore, in Gandhi's view, more politically sound if it was to be considered a politics at all. Put another way, spinning would release Indians from, quote, politics conceived as a practice of conjuring up some future and enable a politics dedicated to the present and achieved in the very moment of expression. Can poetry, practiced physically and materially, similarly release us from traditional politics, one whose promises take us out of the present and toward the production of some future ideal? Yes, I do think so. I know that I seek that release, often quitting poetry, but then coming back to it. Can poetry be framed as akin to spinning, something everyday and disengaged from production, achievement? Well, maybe it's a tall order. I seem to have to pry myself away from houses of literature. Trained, as some of us have been, in creative writing and literature, where it is said overtly or implied that poetry should add up to a commodity written about for money or actually bought and sold, and where poetry conceptualized thusly only links up to freedom in the modern and liberal sense because its freedom is earned via ownership and contracts, all promising more freedom in some individually ideal future, well-timed, because there's a big pause, I shift anxiously toward conceptualizing the unfreedom, this is Devji's word, of poetry's everydayness. Language always being tethered to its own materiality, sounds, its lines, and then writing's role in record-keeping, commerce, but not only this. What kind of practice do I suggest when I write of a poetry practiced physically and materially, and further, a practice embedded in a type of self-rule that Gandhi referred to as unfreedom? A daily walk, then writing down in longhand in a notebook carried around since October. Brown leaf scuttling in the wind, northing its way toward the cemetery. Handwriting, notebook, ink, that is noticing along the same sidewalks, past this house and that building again. Words drift off like clouds, or later as lines across a page already lined, or later told to a lover, I saw a hawk today, or never settling any page, only repeated slightly strange and spinning around, a walk for the sake of walking, and if it should land anywhere, the walk making an arrival, then the how of the poem will show, a petticoat meant to veil, but willing to be seen. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you, Jill and Stephen, for those beautiful readings. I'm going to pull a line from Jill's essay. I'm going to proclaim with this afternoon of visual art, poetry, and weaving that the flowchart space is a point of intersections. So thank you for being here. Check us out online, the Flowchart Foundation. Thank you again, Brandon, for all your help in hanging the show. And hope to see you all again soon. And don't forget, we have books for sale. Yes, notebook books on the right, Jill's book on the left, as well as Stephen's book, and they're all for sale. So thank you all.